Today's April 3rd, and I'm going to open the House Committee on Education, the Subcommittee on Education Innovation. We are starting a little late. It's 1:15, but just for people, I want to go over the agenda real quick. We are not going to hear House Bill 3338 today. There's some amendments being worked on, and so that will not be heard today. And we will just have public hearings and possible work sessions on our other three bills as listed. And so with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2885. And Mr. Olson, if you'd give us a summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2885 directs the Department of Education toward grants to remote and necessary school districts. It establishes the Remote and Necessary School District Fund. Appropriates fund continuously to the department for grants. Sunsets on June 30th, 2009. Appropriates money from the general fund to the department for grants and declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2007. Members of the committee should know there's a dash one amendment under discussion that has not yet been drafted. Also, as House Bill 2885 and is currently drafted, would appropriate $4.4 million out of the general fund to the Remote and Necessary School District Fund. It thus has a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. This afternoon, we have one of the sponsors of the bill with us, and when Representative Dahlem arrives, we'll have him present. But Representative Tina Kotek, if you'd like to share with us your thoughts.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek, State Representative for House District 44 in North and Northeast Portland. And I'm very pleased to be a chief co-sponsor on House Bill 2885 with Representative Dahlem. And when he asked me to consider co-sponsoring, I was very pleased to do so because previously in my role as policy director at Children First for Oregon, I spent about a year and a half traveling both in Oregon and Washington into rural communities to talk about, actually listen, it was a series of focus groups with families about what kind of challenges they have in terms of raising their kids in rural communities. It is really important that we continue to support rural communities, families in those communities to stay there. They want to stay there, but there are all host of issues. Employment issues, access to health care, the quality of their school system. And some of the schools in those very remote areas are small. They lack the capacity of urban areas. And what we do with this fund is provide a little bit of seed money that, from a local control perspective, they can look at what they need to help build their school in a way that really meets their specific needs. Why would someone like me care? Well, I come from, my schools are primarily in North Portland, and I actually feel an affinity to some of the rural areas because my district, one out of every four children lives in poverty. And I'm not saying every child in rural areas lives in poverty, but they have some significant economic disadvantages. And so I think when the urban schools and the urban areas and the rural areas work together, it's really about bringing the state together. And this is a modest effort to provide some additional funds to these schools who are very, very small size to help them meet some of their needs. And I'm very pleased to be a co-sponsor of the bill. So thank you for hearing it, and happy to answer any questions, although Representative Dalton is probably the better expert on the bill. So.
Okay. Well, I just thank you because I know you're in another committee. And so any questions for Representative Kotek while she's here?
Just more of a comment, which is really to applaud you for this, Tina, Representative Kotek. As I know, I might also serve a very urban district, not a rural one, and I've campaigned in that district and know it well, and I suspect, like yours, one of the major concerns of voters in the district are our local schools. But we know, I think you and I probably agree, that we can't get where we need to go with our local schools if there isn't a statewide approach to addressing school funding inadequacy. And this effort at building these bridges to rural schools that face many of the same problems is critical to getting ultimately to that place. So it's not necessarily an easy thing to do politically, but I think it's the right thing to do for the state, and really admire you stepping forward on it.
Thank you, Representative Cannon and Chair Comp. I just would add one thing is, one of the things we heard a lot about when I was on the road in some of these rural communities was this effort to combine school districts.
Mm-hmm.
And how traumatic that is for some communities. The schools are the center of their community life in a lot of ways. And although from an economy of scale issue, combining districts that are very, very geographically far apart might make sense, but that does tremendously, it has a huge impact on those communities. And so hopefully these dollars can help the schools, you know, brainstorm how to keep their schools going the way they are without having kids travel 50, 100 miles away to go to some other school because we think bigger is better. So, and that's not always the case.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And it really isn't a question as much as it's a comment, and I love to take this opportunity to say a few things about these kinds of issues when I get a chance. And the big one to me is the whole idea of equity. And I like to try to correct people misunderstandings as I see it. A lot of people think that everybody should be treated equal and that's equitable. And I say that, no, if you treat everybody exactly the same, it is unequitable. It is not equitable because everybody doesn't need the same things to be in the same place. And for me, when I look at these small schools, if everybody got the same amount on the basic school fund and had to do the same job, it's not possible in these schools. There's not enough money to hire the teachers and do the stuff. And so the schools recognize that they will have differences from the metropolitan school, and their kids are not going to get all the different choices that those kids are going to have. But to provide just a basic, very good education, they're going to need more money. Because to get the math and science and English teachers for this smaller group that can do across grade levels is essential. And we have story after story from these schools and how successful their kids are at meeting the benchmarks, at getting their kids to college and doing other kinds of things. So the process that we've had is working, and the way that we keep it working is make sure that they survive. Mm-hmm. And they will not survive with just the same number of dollars per student. And so this kind of a fund is essential if we want it to be successful and work. So I again applaud you for putting it together and being a part of the bill.
Thank you. And thank you for hearing it.
Thank you, Representative Kotek.
Thank you.
We have two people signed up to testify that definitely live more than 100 miles away, and I think they have a great perspective on this if they'd like to come forward. Paul Young and Mark Jeffrey.
For the record, I am Paul Young.
And for the record, my name is Mark Jeffrey. I'm superintendent of schools for Paisley School District.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And I am superintendent for the Spray School District.
Well, I had prepared comments. I have written testimony, but after hearing the discussion, you seem to really understand the issue well, and I appreciate that. Paisley School District has about 79 students currently enrolled, and we serve the communities of Paisley and Summer Lake. We're 45 miles from our next nearest school district, which is Lake County School District, number 7 to the south, and we're 50 miles from North Lake School District to the north. And so size of school and distance are factors that certainly impact us. First, I'd like to thank the members of this committee for taking the time to address this very important issue. I attended the special session last spring when the legislature stepped up and helped Oregon's largest school district. It was appropriate that we take care of the flagship district of our state. Their 45,000-plus students needed your help, and you came through for them. And what we're asking this session is that you consider the needs of Oregon's smallest and most fragile districts, those currently 12 K-12 districts with under 110 students. And at the top of my written testimony, I've listed those districts. They're Burnt River, Dayville, Fossil, Harper, Huntington, Jordan Valley, Long Creek, Mitchell, Monument, Paisley, Spray, and Ukiah. Each of them in wonderfully remote places. I've traveled to several, including Superintendent Young's district. I can tell you there are some interesting little towns tucked in the middle of nowhere in Oregon. I'm here today representing them, as well as my district, and to let you know that, as you have so well already stated, the bottom line issue is that the bottom line cost of operations for our districts exceeds the total amount of money we receive from the state school fund and our local revenues. And so to fill that gap, we've had to cut staff and cut programs. And the last thing you do is you begin to drain down your reserves, which is only a temporary fix, because eventually you'll run out. And that's where we're heading. And it is our estimation looking at the a number of dollars in each of the district's reserve funds that within the next 2 to 5 years, each of these districts will start to close. And within five, I believe they'll all be closed if something isn't done. The help that is given to us, offered to us through House Bill 2885, is temporary in nature. It will keep us going, and that's really what we're seeking, is the opportunity to survive. We're also requesting that through this next biennium that you consider a study of the issues of how Oregon funds its districts, specifically its smallest districts, to see if we can't come up with a permanent solution. And I know that Superintendent Young and myself, as well as the other 10 superintendents, would be more than willing to be involved in that process. So we run some of Oregon's most efficient schools. Paisley has two elementary teachers and four high school teachers. I also have 1.5 FTE registered teachers. It's three people filling parts of about 1.5 positions. We're our charter school, Oregon's first single school district to go charter. We have done as much as we can come up with in line of seeking efficiencies to make our schools operate in a manner that makes sense for our small districts, but it's still those things. We're limited on what we can do, and we, again, continue to have to spend down our reserves to make up that difference. We have great programs. I've got students in all of Oregon's four-year colleges at this point, universities. I also have a student at Yale Graduate School, another one at Berkeley Grad School. We really do educate some outstanding students and generate some very good graduates. So it isn't like what we've done is to strip down the educational systems in our school, but we have run them as close to that line as possible. I think the members of my community would tell you that I stepped over that line a time or two trying to find that balance between educational efficiency and financial efficiency. We had our fourth, fifth, sixth grade position come vacant the year before last, and I thought, well, let's not fill that position and run the high school teachers in and out of there and make it a fifth through eighth grade. That was really a bad idea educationally. It was not well applauded. It looked great on paper, but in practice that was a really rough year, because what a very young fifth grader needs and a very mature eighth grader needs are very, very different, and what they all need is consistency, and rotating your secondary teachers in and out leaves gaps where they're not as well controlled as maybe they should be. So we've had to add that position back, which, you know, I think what we're running right now for Paisley is where we need to be. The problem is I still will not receive enough money, even with the improved economy, again, based on dollars per student. 80 just isn't sufficient enough in any form under the current funding structure to operate long term.
Thank you. Spray School District is a small school district also. We're about 605 square miles, and we are a very vertical school district. We are in the Rim Rock in the high desert, so our district goes up and down rather than side to side. It makes the transportation issues very, very challenging for us. It also would make it very difficult for us to consolidate with another school district, because whereas they don't look that far away on the map, there are physical barriers that make it just about impossible to get the kids safely from one spot to another. And one of the things that you have in Oregon is you have a very deep and rich history, and one of the most diverse states in the whole United States. We've got the desert. We've got the coastline, we've got the valley, and through that history, our school districts have kind of developed, and they've developed within a structure so they kind of fit the terrain and they fit the structure of the state. I wasn't born and raised in Spray. I was hired and I came in, and I have a heart for the small school districts. I just really love them, and it hurts me deeply to look at what I'm going to have to do to that school district in the next 2 years if I have to spend the amount of money that I'm going to have coming in. Because for the last several years, I have refused not to give those kids an adequate education, which means that I've spent off all of my excess funding. I have reached the line. As a matter of fact, as several of us were reaching that line, the 12 remote and necessary school districts all started talking to each other, because that we could see the end of the tunnel coming, and we understood that at a point in the not too distant future we weren't going to be here for Oregon. And Mr. Dahlem got involved with us, And then we were able to actually make contact a little bit later with the Portland School District, and they came down and we met with them, and we found out that they're dealing with a lot of the same issues that we're dealing with. It was just amazing to me to find out that the largest school district in the state was thinking about several of the same issues that we were dealing with here. And there are some real differences. I don't have major drug problems. I don't need police in my school. But I have 64 children, and that's high school through kindergarten, and I have to maintain buildings for every one of those kids. So I can't fit as many kids in a building as you can in a larger school district, which means that it simply costs me more per kid to keep a roof over their head and to keep a teacher in the classroom. I've had to let my staff go down to a point where right now I am meeting all of the highly qualified requirements for the state of Oregon. But I can tell you frankly, I cannot let another staff person go and still do that. And the day will come when one of my staff members retires, and I have no idea how I'm going to be able to pull somebody back in, because I have teachers that are carrying 4 and 5 certifications. Why in the world would anyone with 4 or 5 certifications come to Spray? They came to Spray and loved it and then picked up the certifications. I'm in a point right now where I can tell you folks, Spray cannot go on like we are. I don't have any more excess funds to spend off. Something's going to happen, or I'm going to have to go find another school district, and that's going to hurt me. I can go, but those kids can't.
Thank you. If you just want to wait just a second, Representative Dolan. Representative Rodman?
Yeah, I just want to ask a question. You are the only, well the first, full-time charter district. And as such, how many of your staff are certified? Because you don't have to all be.
Correct. Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, currently we have 6 certified, and I have 3 individuals that are registered. But as I mentioned, they fill about 1.5 FTE, and it's in areas of art, music, physical education, and health, where it's very difficult to bring. Or I need 2 periods of PE a day. I'm not going to hire somebody. Find somebody who's willing to come and work part-time in Paisley that would be able to do that. So we're able to go out in the community and find folks who have that, fortunately, and it comes and goes with the folks as they come and go. So,
Representative Buckley?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jeffrey, I have 2 questions for you. One, I believe in your testimony you mentioned that your concern is that if we supply this funding through the grant program, that even this might not be enough. 2 years from now, you will have to come back and seek additional funding. Do you see a leveling off at some point in terms of your financial picture? Would this type of program, if enacted on a continuous basis, be enough to keep the remote school districts going?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, that's an excellent question. Our intent has always been that this be temporary in nature, to give the legislature, the state of Oregon, time to really seek a solution to the issues we face, because it's challenging to, whenever you put dollars per student and that number of student drops below that line of affordability, the issue really becomes, and I think Representative Roblin mentioned equity. What we would like to see is a study that looks at, baseline program funding, where, and I really believe that what Paisley is operating right now is a quality program. Any student that I have that is willing to put in the work to maintain the GPA and qualify for the SAT scores can attend any college they want. I mean, we're proof of that. Students everywhere from the community colleges to Yale. It's the amount of work they put in. So we aren't running a stripped down program, but program costs go up every year, and to say that the amount of money we're seeking this biennium would be sufficient for the next, I don't know that I could make that claim. And it is Our enrollment has stabilized. I mean, on average, we run about 80 kids. Right now, we have 79. A family can leave, and I can lose 5 to 20% of my enrollment, depending on how many kids they take with them. So,
leave the kids behind.
Right. But it would certainly be of assistance. I look at it like someone with a wound, and they're bleeding out. And what we're really doing here is constricting that wound, so we're not going to bleed out as quickly. But until we, you know, find a solution that would ultimately end that and allow us to, when I first took the position 6 years ago, I had an interim superintendent in my place, and he said, you know, the financial situation looks really good. I think you're going to be okay. And I thought, well, that's wonderful. He left, June 31st, and I took the job July 1. Within that first week, I got a letter from the Department of Ed, and they had made an adjustment in the March estimate downward of $100,000. And that was also followed by that very famous September 11th and the shock to the economy. Within my first 18 to 24 months, I had to cut $286,000 out of a $1.4 million budget. It was really an interesting experience. And so what I am longing for is the opportunity to do things like I thought I was going to do when I first sat behind the desk, and that was work on things like curriculum and, you know, all the things you dream about and you're taught about in administrator school, not having to focus 6 years just on funding, so, and the legislative process.
Good follow-up?
Yes.
Thank you very much
sure.
for that answer. The definition of the remote and necessary school districts, Are we in danger with this definition of leaving like the next level out? I'm thinking of like Pinehurst School District in my district. Are there other rural schools that have maybe 120 students who we're just not paying attention to? To your knowledge, are there other rural school districts that we should be paying attention to?
And I was going to say, I know Representative Dahl has been researching this intensely. If you want him to answer that.
Madam Chair, that would be a wonderful thing.
Do you want me to join these people?
Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I didn't want you to steal the stage from them, Representative.
I just really like your fashion choice today, Representative. I think it's a very, very nice-looking coat that you're wearing.
Madam Chair, for the record, Representative John Dollum, House District 59. These two gentlemen serve schools that are in my district. The second thing I should do is apologize to the chair for my tardy entrance and to my two colleagues that took the dais before me. I'm prepared to give you an introduction that I think will eliminate a lot of the questions. So I'll start with my introduction. And with your permission, Madam Chair, then I will address Representative Buckley's question. You've heard testimony from Portland. I'm sure my colleague has done an outstanding job. She's far more eloquent than I. You've heard testimony from the two superintendents. We need House Bill 2885. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the bill and how we got here. Last session, when Portland was hard after additional operating revenue, I was not supportive. And the Portland people came to my office, and the then speaker put together a bill for a funding scheme that brought them in. And the important thing is here that we established a relationship. Me representing very small districts and the Portland School Board representing the largest school district. That bill came unraveled and went away, and Sine die came and went, but it did start a dialogue between us. During the interim, we started meeting, and we met in such hot spots around the state as Mitchell, Fossil, Spray, John Day. I don't think we got to Paisley. We did not make very many phone calls that were not long distance. And as I was meeting with these people and other superintendents, by the way, some things became apparent. One, we needed Portland's support. We just absolutely needed them. As we came into special session, we handled the Portland Public School District's problem, and I was a little disconcerned and said to my colleague Arnie, or pardon me, Representative Roblin, we're sunk. And I told him this morning I'm going to quote him, and he said, well, we'll take care of you. The time will come. That the day is here. This is our time. This is our chance. This is our opportunity to say to these people that represent such small schools, you are part of Oregon. Your school is important. During those meetings, we came up with a definition of remote and necessary. And we also talked about economy of scale and the dramatic impact that economy of scale has. For example, a large school can fill a class, and I'm not sure what the breakover is. Some say 240 in a high school, somewhat large in an elementary. But a large school can fill each class to the capacity that it determines it has to. And in these days, I'm sorry to say those numbers are larger than we'd like. But they can fill classes. A teacher can see four or five classes that are filled with 30 students apiece, or 28 or 26, whatever that number is. In the schools that we're talking about, that opportunity doesn't exist. You fill to the maximum that the school has, and it can be six students. But you have to have government. You have to have the discussion. The cost for the teacher for those six is exactly the same as the cost of the teacher when you're dealing with 30. And that economy of school, of scale crept into the conversation at almost every juncture. There is absolutely additional costs that schools on the small side face that they cannot overcome. Another one that was most interesting, we went with Portland, and if you do the math, the Portland School District has about 47,000 students. And if you divide that into the Portland School Superintendent's salary, they're getting a deal. It's 2 cents a student or something similar, maybe 3 cents. 3 cents would put her into 100,000. And if we gave her 4 cents, she'd be at 2,000 a year. And if we gave her 5 cents a student, she'd be at $250,000 a year. In our small schools where we have 45 students, and that's the smallest one I believe we dealt with, you can see that the cost per student for a superintendent is astronomical. And so economy of scale, with just those two examples, gives you some notion of how difficult it is to make things pay when you are remote, when you are isolated, and when your nearest neighbor is across a mountain, across a river, or just distance away from you that you cannot cooperate. We do have some cooperating deals that I'd really like to tell you about. But the next thing that we discovered was a term that kept creeping into the conversation was critical mass. And before the school ever opens the doors, they must pay utilities. They must do building maintenance. They must provide transportation. And these costs are, although not static year to year, cannot be reduced anymore. And so there is a certain critical mass that these schools have to have. And when you have 45 students, if you multiply that times $5,000, you can see that just opening the door is going to consume a large part of your state funding formula. So I would like to say, as we went over the bill, and again, I would like to particularly thank Chair Kump and Representative Roblin for their patience with me. This morning in Chair Kump's office, we realized as we went through the bill line by line that there are some things that need to be fixed. And I will tell you that with these superintendents and with our committee administrator and with the legislative council's assistance and legislative administration, there are a few things that we have to iron out. The first one is we started out with the interest returned to the pool. That's not going to happen. We'd like an opportunity to fix that. There were some things that became immediately obvious to me this morning, that if you give me the budget and tell me I qualify for extra money with the numbers in the budget, those are the numbers that'll be in the budget. And we want an opportunity to fix that so that it doesn't become a manipulative thing. Also, now I am to Representative Buckley's question, how many schools are involved? And when we talked with Ledge Administration, there were 7 schools we had never considered that may qualify. We may have 13 that 2 or 3 don't qualify. And we want to be sure that our definition of remote and rural, by the qualifiers we put in there, ensures that everyone's included and that no one is excluded. So with that, I'll take your questions. And again, I cannot say to you enough, thank you for your patience with me.
Oh, Representative Dahlin, you're worth every cent. I don't know how many students you're representing at this point, but I hope they're getting, well, I know they're getting their money's worth, so.
Thank you.
Was your question answered, Representative Buckley?
I look forward to further discussion on trying what that definition, where the, how many schools fit into that, how many school districts fit into that.
Thank you.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Chair Kampf, and thank you all. I sort of wanted to follow up on, I think, Representative Buckley's first question, which related to sustainability over time. And I'm trying to understand, I think, to get there, I need to understand better what is creating the problem for small schools. And I'm wondering if you can, or small school districts, I'm wondering if you can, how you would distinguish between those needs that are really structural and drive costs for particularly small school districts, so things such as the building that you've just absolutely got to have, and it spreads costs among fewer students than it would in a large district, the courses that are educationally just critical, and, you know, whether there are three students in the course or 10, you know, it's going to be a teacher, and you're not able to spread those costs among as many, the superintendent, you know, in Representative Dallin's example. So the distinction between those sort of structural examples that you gave, and then those that examples that are things that are driving costs that are coming from the state in terms of requirements that you're required to follow. And I don't know if, I can't remember if it's your bill, Representative Dallin, but we did hear earlier in the session a bill that would exempt, you know, small school districts from a certain number of state requirements. And so I'm wondering, you know, how do we, if we really try to solve this in the long run, maybe both are necessary, but if you can distinguish between...
Let me put this into perspective. As we met, and the numbers varied, I'm going to say that there was, on occasion, 13 schools and sometimes as few as six, but the notion was that of the schools in the room, within 2 years, all of them would be gone. Or most of them would be gone, and within 3 years, all of them would be gone. And my statement was that, and I think we came to some concurrence, that if, and as we crafted the definition of remote and necessary, we wanted the certainty to be there, that the legislature knew, and that the state of Oregon knew, that we died not with a whimper, but with a bang. We did not provide a long-term solution. We are providing hanging-on funds so that while we deal with this question, do we want to spend this kind of money for 79 students? And maybe we really do want to look at that, but we felt that given the time and given what was in front of us and what we had, we could not solve the long-term solution. My explanation as a freshman legislator, as our group met, and with a limited understanding of the process, I knew that we couldn't get into the formula and ask for continued support. I've had discussions with my colleague. Equity is an issue. That is an issue. And so we determined that we would ask for sustaining report, sustaining money while the legislature discussed, is this what we want to support? And if it's not what we want to support, we have some time to gear down, and we have made a conscious decision knowing what the results would be. So that's the reason for the 2 years.
Well, just a follow-up comment. I mean, I think I understand what you're saying and the need to do something now while we work and answer those questions related to long-term support, and I would be very interested in participating in that process and finding out more about what the underlying challenges are and whether there are ways that we can, you know, if it's alter the formula or address some of these requirements that put, you know, create all the same obligations for very small school districts as we have for large ones with respect to specialties, et cetera. And I think that's just a really interesting and important question, and I appreciate you raising it. So,
thanks. Thank you.
I was going to say, we do have two more people yet to testify on this bill. Representative Roblin?
I'll just make a quick one because I think I want to address Representative Buckley's question a little bit, too, in the sense that, truthfully, I see you and that next level of schools, especially the ones that are small, that have declining enrollment, because that puts a double whammy on them, as the canaries for our system, because in the mines, they put the canaries in first and find out how they're going to, if they die, then it's not safe for the rest of them. Well, the reality is these smaller schools and the ones that are just a little larger, you know, your school district, the Mapleton School District, some of these others, those of us in some of these other areas are looking at them because we don't know how they're hanging on. And when they go, it'll start building momentum for some of these other schools, you know, the Reed Sports and the next ones that in the next level. If we don't figure out how to deal with how do we provide, and I think your answer, how do we budget based on, you know, how much does it cost to provide these particular services so that kids have an equitable education as opposed to, that's going to be have a discussion that we have to have. We don't have time to do it right now, so I appreciate you bringing the bill forward.
Representative Wisnett, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, are we going to do work session on this?
No, not today because we have some amendments.
I'll defer my question.
Okay. Thank you to this panel.
Thank you very much
for
the opportunity.
Thank you for all your work in teaching and educating.
Appreciate it.
We have...
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
Could we get some background information before the work session on how many schools and how much money and all that so we can...
Yes, absolutely. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I understand from talking to the Legislative Revenue Office, they're working on a draft revenue statement, and after the Dash 1 amendments are drafted, they'll be able to better hone some of that information, and I will work to have that ready by the next time we deal with this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And just so that you know kind of the timeline, we're also thinking we're looking at hopefully working this bill, if everything's in place, a week from today.
Thank you.
So time is moving quickly ahead. With that, I'm going to ask Eileen Flynn and David Williams to come testify. Representative Wilson, I need to step out for a minute.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eileen Flynn, and I'm the Legislative Director for Portland Public School District. I am happily here on behalf of Superintendent Vicki Phillips and Board Co-Chairs Dan Ryan and Bobby Regan and School Board Member David Wind. Portland Public Schools supports the efforts of Representative John Dallam and Representative Tina Kotick to assist Oregon's smallest and most remote school districts. Last November, Superintendent Phillips and the Board Co-Chairs Regan and Ryan traveled to Fossil, Oregon at the invitation of Paisley Superintendent Mark Jeffrey. They spent the day hearing from superintendents from Fossil, Paisley, Ukiah, Jordan Valley, Spray, Harper, Mitchell Monument, Huntington, and others. One thing that did come out of that meeting was that while Portland may have over 45,000 more students than all of those districts combined, we are all declining enrollment districts with the same goal, to provide our children with the best education possible. We believe House Bill 2885 represents a bipartisan effort that bridges the gap between urban and rural school districts throughout Oregon with a focus on quality education for all of Oregon's K-12 school students, regardless of their location. Portland Public Schools encourages your support of this legislation, which will create a temporary two-year special fund totaling $4.4 million, which will provide these districts with up to $200,000 each. These funds will help Oregon's remote and necessary school districts face some difficult challenges unique to districts of this size. According to a report by the Oregon Department of Education, it costs 50% more to run a school with 120 students than one with 1,000 students due to the fixed costs such as salaries, utilities, and transportation. In addition, under the current state funding formula, the remote necessary school districts oftentimes do not receive sufficient revenues to continue long-term operations, wherein the loss of one student from such a district has a much greater impact on the district than the loss of one student from Portland Public School District. The importance of these school districts to Oregon cannot be overlooked. Portland Public School Board of Education Co-Chair Dan Ryan, who's a fourth-generation Oregonian, explained it best to me, and I'm only a 20-month transplant from the East Coast, Oregon. He said, quote, "After spending the day in Fossil with the education leaders of our state's remote necessary districts, I became convinced that core funding for their K-12 programs is an important issue for all Oregonians. As a fourth-generation Oregonian, I want to preserve the rich cultural heritage of our state. In these isolated rural settings, the school is the den, living room, and family room for the entire town. If we do not adequately fund these districts, the schools will shut down, forcing families to relocate. Let's preserve the heritage of this state by doing more than supporting summer recreation to these scenic respites. Let's show our respect for the hardworking families that tend to this rugged land by committing adequate funds to their K-12 schools. This legislation will not solve the long-term problems facing these in many of Oregon's school districts, but it will provide short-term relief and allow all of us, from the legislature to the education community, time to search for a more appropriate solution to the funding inadequacy facing all of Oregon's schools. Thank you once again for the opportunity to be here today, and we strongly encourage your support of this legislation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association. Just here to lend our support to this conversation. I think Representative Dallin pointed out best in talking about the policy debate that really does need to occur around these types of districts. And I would hazard that it's more than just those that will be included in the definition of this bill. Thinking of any number of our declining enrollment small rural districts around the state who, while may not be on the verge of bankruptcy, as some of these districts are certainly losing dollars every year, even in a growing a state revenue system that we're in. And the other point I'll posit with all of you is I'd like to think that under an ideal situation where we may be funding schools at a full quality ed model level, which may seem like pie in the sky, but under, I think, that full quality ed model, we may not be having this debate because there would be adequate resources in the system to fund schools around the state. But I think that the policy debate we're having here, again, I think is extremely valuable when we talk about the watchwords being run our districts efficiently like a business, find efficiencies where we can. And, you know, I love the example of the cost per student for your superintendent because I think that just goes exactly to the heart. And, of course, as Representative Dallin would know, that oftentimes that superintendent is also the bus driver and the facilities manager and any number of other hats that they wear. I'll relay one story. When we travel around the state often, we pulled into Ione out in Morrow County and pulled up to the school district, and the superintendent of the district is coming up out of the bowels of the district to go to the hardware store to get some bearing for their boiler or pump or something like that because of the many hats that that these rural district employees wear out there. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Vice Chair Roland. Mr. Williams, would you have the information that I was referring to earlier? Could possibly get a list of school districts with the number of students in each school district? And I know that you might not have this easily accessible, but their geographic location in terms of their proximity to a city of population size.
Sure. Yeah, definitely ADM, ADMW per district. You can do that. I'll see if we can pull up as far as proximity to urban areas. The department may be able to help us on this as well. I don't want to volunteer people behind.
Brian's here, and
yeah,
I think they have
I'm
a lot
sure
of information.
I'm sure we'll be able to work up something for the committee.
I appreciate that.
Definitely.
And Representative Dahl must answer that question.
We'll see to it. We're going to, the superintendents and myself, put together some rudimentary information. We'll get a room. You'll get an invite. So will Mr. Reeder, and we'll go to work on it.
Yes.
ASAP.
Representative, if I could just
yes,
comment since we're here. Representative Dahl, I also mean to see which of these districts have tried a local option and whether the people of those districts have made that kind of step forward as well.
Okay. Any other questions? No? Thank you. Is there anybody else?
No, that's all that's
good. Is there anyone else here who would like to testify to House Bill 2885? Seeing none, we will close our public hearing on 2885, and we'll open a public hearing. Yeah, we can do that. It appears that there's a lot of crossover on these next two bills, so we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3178 and on House Bill 3179, so we can take testimony on both at the same time. Center co-sponsors of these next two bills. And me too. I'll get on there. So I'll have our administrator give a short explanation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3178 directs school districts, education service districts, and public bodies to make available public lists of vacant and unused buildings and portions of buildings that may be suitable for operation of public charter school. Directs that lists must be provided to developing or operating public charter schools within 30 days of written requests. For 3178, there's a dash one amendment, which just clarifies that you'd only have an approved charter proposal, not necessarily approved charter, to take part in that, and that's dash one amendments are before you. Madam Chair, the next bill is, which we'll also be hearing, is House Bill 3179, which changes the information that school district board may request from a public charter school applicant, changes the criteria for approving public charter school proposal, specifies time periods for the appeal of a denial of an application for a public charter school and for the State Board of Education to review, allows a public charter school or sponsor to request State Board review of whether specified provisions have been violated, and it declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2007. Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are two amendments before you. The dash one amendment would do a couple things. One, it would add in statute the option of a conditional approval of a public charter school based on the requirements of federal and state, saying that the requirements of federal and state law and school board policies that follow the legislative intent for charter schools need to be completed. It would also expand the time given to the Department of Education to complete the review to 150 days, if it's 120 days, and it would give some flexibility in the timeline. The dash two amendment would do the same, except it would not put in statute the issue of conditional approval. So the amendments are, it's sort of a one or the other. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Dellum, would you like to lead off?
I'm not Karen Hikes.
Pardon me?
We'll bring Karen Hikes.
All right, Karen?
Join
in.
Karen,
I know I shouldn't do that.
Yeah. I know,
Karen.
Really like to start with someone that knows
about it. If you'll state, if you begin with stating your name and Karen Hikes, Charter Schools Development Center. Karen
And I'm going to start. I guess the superintendent gets to start, the former superintendent. First, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the first bill, which directs the Department of Education to grant, to award grants to remote and necessary school districts. And basically what we're doing is asking that remote and necessary school districts be given.
Go to the next one.
Hey, I hit all of you. You're all single, double, or triple, and a whole
lot. I'm sorry. I need to open the hearing on House Bill 3179. Let's begin with that one.
I didn't vote. Which
we didn't vote. 3179 and 3178.
I actually opened the polls.
Okay. You opened. All right. And sorry.
No problem.
Can I start at 3178?
Yes. What's on you?
President Don, we are in House Bill 3178. Thank you. You can start there.
Now that I know what room I'm in and what time it is and what bill we're on, I'd be pleased to start. For the record, Representative John Dollum, House
Thank
District
you.
59. And the genesis of House Bill 3178 starts before Oregon even had a charter school law. In my time in Oregon, I served in a district that, because of the compression that our district was forced to go into with equalization, reaching equalization, it was a painful time. We had been spending in excess of $7,000 per student and had to get under that. And one of the things that we did was abandon the school buildings in one of our small communities and ultimately two of our small communities and left them vacant. And because we had people in those communities that wanted, desperately felt they needed the opportunity to send their kids to neighborhood schools, they petitioned the district to use the buildings. And at first the petition was agreed to. The building was leased, and I might remind you, this was before the Oregon legislature had put into place charter school legislation, 1993, I believe. As we went through the year and the charter school developed and the students were able to attend their neighborhood school, a rift developed between the governing board and the charter school board. And without legislation to guide them, the local district revoked the charter, took back the building, and left our school bereft of any place to go. It would seem to me in that situation where we had facilities available, we had community available, that we ought to be able to make available the facilities when a charter group wants to hold on desperately to that school. I'll defer to Karen as to how many times that situation exists. But back to our story, when Karen came to my office with this piece of legislation, those memories surfaced. And I thought it is time, and it is appropriate, that we make district facilities available to those that will use them, in the cases that I know and understand, use them wisely, and use them for their proper purpose, which is the education of the children in that district. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Representative Dahl? Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3178.
Indeed.
I have had the opportunity to work within the charter school laws of the state of Oregon and be involved in a couple charter schools that were formed. I better start over. I'm Representative Arnie Roblin, representing
for the
House District 9. Thanks.
Well, I'm glad you did that.
You did. And had the opportunity to work in our school district with some charter schools. And I guess the thing that I like to remind people that I appreciate in our charter school laws in this state is that these are public charter schools. They are Oregon schools. And that's an important thing to remember. And they represent an opportunity for Oregon students to get an education. I am pleased that in our charter school law we require that they go and get the local school district and give an explanation and a plan as to how they're going to provide this education. I think those should be very rigorous, and I think most of them are. And I think that there needs to be an understanding in that district of what kind of education that is going to be provided, and they're still responsible for those kids because they are Oregon students, and this is a school board that's going to be responsible for that charter school as well. In that, one of the biggest reasons that charter schools fail is the financial burden that's placed upon them in finding places to be. And in areas like ours, in rural Oregon, there are school buildings that exist and don't have any students in them or very few. And so the facilities are available. And when that comes about, a building being used has a much greater chance of maintaining itself. When you leave schools vacant, they fall apart. And I think it's a loss of investment for our local school districts when we don't have people that are using them. So I think it can serve both purposes. In our district, in Coos Bay, the district and the cooperated with and had a very tight relationship with the formation of our schools, and they have always been within school buildings in our school district. And I think that has been a valuable thing for all of us. I think that when they're in the buildings, the chances of being there to oversee and see what's going on is heightened. There is a relationship that gets to be built between the school district and that charter school, which I think makes it a better environment for everyone. So from my perspective, I see this as a win-win situation for districts and for charter schools. And so I was pleased to be asked and to participate in the discussion of this bill. Do you want us to talk about the other one as well right now, or should we?
Well, we finished this
okay.
one. Is there some different folks that want to testify on this one? Ms. Hinkle, or I'm sorry, Ms. Hikes.
Representative Minnis and members of the committee, I'm Karen Hikes from the Charter Schools Development Center, and first of all, I would like to thank Representative Dahlem and Representative Roblin for agreeing to sponsor this bill, and thank all of you for agreeing to co-sponsor it, as well as Representative Comp and Senator Walker. We request that you support this bill. This bill as Derek mentioned, would require districts and other public agencies, so community colleges, universities, cities, counties, et cetera, state, would require the public agencies with existing unused facilities or portions of existing facilities to negotiate for leasing or purchasing with charter schools. Facilities is consistently listed as the number one challenge for charter schools in our state and nationally. Traditional public schools, as you know, pass bonds. Charter schools in our state are not able to do that. And they receive less funding, quite a bit less funding than traditional schools. So financially, they really are at a disadvantage in terms of being able to afford facilities. Right now, and we don't have any per pupil funding for charter facilities on our books, which blocks us from being eligible for federal charter facility grants, which is unfortunate. The good news is that about 60% of our charter schools now use district-owned space. So many of our districts are very generous with the charter schools, and some of those charter schools pay market rate. Some of them pay less than market rate. Some of them don't pay for their buildings at all. But because of all the fluctuating factors in districts, these arrangements cannot be relied on long-term. Only 5 of the charter schools in Oregon own their own buildings, and really only 3 of them do, because 2 of them are owned by their kind of mothership nonprofits. So the vast majority of our charter schools, this is really an issue for them. This bill would not fully solve the problem. However, it would provide an option that would benefit some charter schools who would have access to buildings in their communities that they don't currently have access to. I want to talk about a little bit about the phrase in good faith, because this law requires districts to negotiate or public agencies to negotiate in good faith with charter schools. And I've talked to some lawyers, and I will defer to any lawyers in the room because I am not one. But my understanding is that good faith is best defined by what it's not. It's not arbitrary, and it's not capricious. I'm getting some nods. That's a good thing. So for the issue at hand, presumably good faith would mean that districts and other public agencies would not predetermine whether to lease or sell to a charter school one way or the other, whether to do it or whether to not do it, that they would follow their policies, that they would follow their procedures, that they would not give priority to a charter school, they would not be obligated to lease or sell to a charter school, but that they must give them a fair shake as if they were any other prospective tenant or buyer. And I don't know if you want to speak to the amendments. I know there's a dash one and a dash two. Oh, you're right. Dash one, all it does is add the word. You're right. I'm getting confused. So I think that's about it. If you have any questions, or I don't know if there are people that are signed up to testify on this.
Representative Whitman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, is anyone from ODE going to testify? My question is more directly, I think, to ODE. Is anyone signed up to?
Stephanie Hinkle with ODE.
That's Stephanie Hinkle's with Trillium Charter School.
All right. No, I don't see anyone here.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Wisdom, we do have someone from the Department of Education that is available if we have questions, but no one was scheduled to testify.
Because committee members, Madam Chair, my question is, I signed on this bill, so I support it. But I want to be sure it does something. And I'm concerned about the paragraph for Section 5. We say, shall make available to the public list of vacant and unused public buildings. I would hope we have that already available, but the way this is it's written now is you have to request it and you're going to get the list. And also I'm concerned because this is an education or charter school bill. How are we going to get, you know, other government agencies to be aware of this and know they need to respond or something? I want to make it more effective. I mean, that's my point, is, you know, are more responsive too, so we have the needs.
I'll take a stab at it, and we may have to ask this others. But you know, I believe that one of DAS's in DAS, they have to keep understanding of what government buildings are vacant or whatever, and they have that list. So, but a local charter school at least would know where to go and ask for that list. And you're not going to ask for the whole state; you're going to ask for this one little locality. So your local school district, or you know, those other government agencies, the county would probably know that. And it's still the responsibility of the local charter. There's no reason for a group to anticipate that and be posting it all the time. It would be this person starting, they're organizing, they're forming, and now they know there's a law that says I can go to the county and ask them if they have any. I can go to these other people, and when I ask, they have a right. I have the right to get an answer. So that's kind of what it does in my understanding of the bill.
I think I could answer that question. Having been involved with the establishment of three charter schools, I can tell you that when they start down the... they have an inordinate amount of enthusiasm, a tremendous grit, and if offered this arrow to put in their quiver, and knowing what Karen will do when they start forming a charter, they will now present themselves to the city, the school district, the county, and say, it says in the law that if you have an empty building, you should consider us. I think if we build the opportunity, they will come.
Thank you.
Representative Buckley?
Thank you, Vice Chairman. I guess, Karen, maybe you would be the best person to answer this, given the good faith negotiations issue of this. If, for instance, I'm trying to play devil's advocate here. If, for instance, there was a district, decline enrollment district, they had some schools they had closed down, there was a charter school effort, but the district said, you know what, we really want to take these buildings and we want to flatten them and we want to sell the property because the property is so valuable and we'll be able to use that money for our district. Would, in your understanding of this, would that still be within good faith negotiations? This doesn't obligate the district to sell the buildings or lease
right.
the buildings.
Well, the building wouldn't be available
building
for
wouldn't
lease
be available.
Or sale.
Yes, exactly.
The district would decide to not make it available. They would decide to tear it down.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
That's what I think.
Very good. I'll seek a little bit more legal counsel on that as well. Thank you.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Do you want to jump in here?
Well, I'm sorry.
I was just going to add a little bit more. Oftentimes, school districts do not like to get rid of their buildings because there's stuff in them that they would rather sell to the person else to get rid of.
Yeah.
So there are, I mean, destroying these buildings that have been around for a long time have with them certain other things, and it costs a lot of money for districts sometimes to rid themselves of buildings. It's easier to sell the whole thing, and you get a better price. So it would depend on how they were going about doing it. And, again, in the good faith would be, if you want to buy it, you can buy it, but we're going to put it out for bid, and the other bid's going to bid. You'd still be in good faith if you let all of them bid. And if they had the winning bid, they'd get it. If they didn't, it'd go to the other one. It's still the district.
I might answer that question even more directly, having been involved with a school district that created two empty buildings and had a charter school in each. In the shed building, the charter school moved into Corvallis, and we ended up selling the building to a trucking firm. Land use issues became huge, but in the interim, when we were looking at something to do with our far-flung enterprise, the charter school was one of the considerations on the list, and it happened to be the one that we felt, in that particular case, would take the best care of the building in the interim. In the other situation, right now, District 21, one of the newer districts in the state, when they consolidated Chenoweth and the Dalles, they did create excess inventory. And the first consideration was to count and make log of everything they had. And as Karen has pointed out, the H.G. Wilson School was slated for demolition. A middle school that's standing empty now. This bill would give some charter people the opportunity to say, can we take a shot at it? Now, that doesn't mean they'd get it, but that means that they would have to be on the list of considered proprietors that could make that building more than an empty building for the district.
Representative Kent.
Thank you. I really appreciate the thinking behind this bill, that if there is unused space in a district, or any public agency, there's a charter school that is trying to find space, it makes all the sense in the world to use that available space. But if I read between the lines in here, we're talking about some instances where the public school district is not being very cooperative. Because, I mean, let's be honest, if the space is there and the charter school is looking for space, one would think that without legislation, the district principal, board, whoever is making these decisions, and the charter school applicants would get together and say, yeah, here's a spot that works. So I'm reading between the lines, and I'm imagining this sort of confrontational situation. And I just wonder to what extent, you know, we can really solve the problem of the breakdown in trust or relationship between the applicant and the district through a law like this. And we do this all the time in the legislature. We try to solve problems through statute that really involve relationships. And, you know, we had a bill we passed this morning I supported on nutrition in schools where, you know, we're going to make sure that the food that's sold is more nutritious to try to address an obesity issue, which kind of goes back to homes and eating habits and things that are beyond the purview of, I believe, legislation to really, truly address. So is this really going to help?
My response? Yes. And Representative Cannon, your perception and reading between the lines, I did not want to sit here today and tell you of all the difficult times that I've been through with charter schools. I thought perhaps I could talk about the positive things as my colleague Representative Wilburn does. But when you arm the charter school group with this information, You're now, and there is a natural competition. In the cases that I'm aware of, and I certainly cannot speak with the depth and the breadth of information that Ms. Hikas has, but I know that the schools I've been associated with, there is a natural competition between them, and that competition, in my opinion, fosters a better charter school and a better public school. And your perception is absolutely correct, but what we have done is armed the charter school people with an arrow in their quiver that says they must sit down and at least talk about it. If the three of us could have, or at least myself, I guess I better speak for myself, if I could have legislated a relationship, I'd have given that a shot. But I think this is the next best thing.
Representative Cannon and members of the committee, I'm thinking of the starfish analogy for this. You know, when you're throwing the starfish back in the ocean, that you can't save them all, but you can save a few, and it matters to those starfish. I think I got that right. It's been a while since I've heard it. I guess the bottom line is I think this will make a difference for some of our charter schools. You're absolutely right in reading between the lines that there certainly have been situations. Not everyone operates in good faith all the time, unfortunately. And I don't know that this is as much relational as it is political. You know, charter schools are very political. And many districts are very supportive of charter schools. Some districts, you know, are not. And so I would say it's more political than personal in terms of, you know, the applicant or having problems with the applicant. It's more a philosophy about, you know, charter schools and public schools and choice and those sorts of things.
While you're there, why don't we go ahead and we're kind of running out of time here. Let's move on to 3179 and give your overview of that, and then we'll call the remaining members up on both bills. Representative Roepeling, would you like to begin?
Karen, we'll let Karen go first.
Karen.
I can't believe I did that. Karen.
The grace period.
Thanks, Karen.
I shouldn't say that. I should. Okay. Okay, let me shift gears here. These bills are connected because they both relate to charter schools. Other than that, they address fairly different issues. So what this bill would do, well, first of all, CSDC, who we are a statewide nonprofit, and we have members of, we are a membership-based organization. We have districts that are members. We have charter schools that are members. We have developers that are members. We survey all our folks on a regular basis about what their priorities are in terms of policies and other things. And this bill emerged because these issues were identified as priorities by our members and by other partners. And Derek outlined what this bill would do. Essentially, this bill relates to the chartering process that's outlined in the charter law, and it addresses two problems. One is conditional charter approvals, and two is the lengthy appeals process. So on piece number one, again, most people operate in good faith. Not everybody does. There's a fairly rigorous charter school review process outlined in statute, and it should be rigorous, and we certainly support a rigorous process. And there's a two-step process where charter applicants submit a proposal. The board either approves it or denies it. If they approve it, they move on. They negotiate a contract. If they deny it, the group can either reapply or they appeal to the state. So that seems like a fairly clean piece. Sometimes, however, districts give very lengthy, multiple-page board resolutions with conditional approvals of these charters that include conditions that are fairly outside the bounds of normal, what I would consider normal, law, statute, rule, etc. Some districts do things like requiring a charter school to give them $50,000 to pay for half of their superintendent's FTE so that they can attend all the board meetings and oversee the charter school. That's an extreme situation, but it has happened, and that school has never opened because they would not agree to that condition, understandably so. Some conditions go without saying. Have to have a facility before your school opens. Has to meet code, etc. We have a couple amendments for this bill, but we're thinking that in order to address some of the abuses that have happened legislatively, we should either disallow conditional approvals, which I don't think is reasonable, because I think given the various factors and the dynamics and the groups that apply and the capacity of the groups, the boards need to have the ability to give some conditions on the approval of the charter proposal. However, I think we do need to put some criteria around the conditional approvals and say that they need to be based on law, they need to be based on rules, and they need to be based on district policies that are consistent with the legislative intent of the charter law, which outlines, you know, 9 goals, etc. We're concerned about some policies that some boards have adopted over the last 6 months, per the encouragement of OSBA, that require, you know, 100 elements, 100 pieces of information in the charter proposal instead of the 25 required by statute. Many of those elements certainly need to be in place before the school opens, but not a year prior to the school opening, which is when most charter applicants apply. We're thinking that some of those pieces are outside of the scope of responsible oversight. We're not sure why these policies were created or why they're distributed to districts. I've talked to a number of folks at OSBA. I work with them as positively as I can. I haven't really gotten to the bottom of why the 16-page policies are out there floating around free on their website and distributed to districts, and why that makes solid sense policy-wise. And I have handed out the policies for your review so you can draw your own conclusion. But I am concerned about these conditional approvals that can overhaul the proposal's intent, the vision of the school, the model, and put undue, unreasonable requirements on the charter applicant. I think that's it on that piece. The other piece is the appeals process, which there just aren't any timelines on it. There are timelines on about every other step in the charter law. I think this was probably just an oversight originally. I've heard from ODE that they've had a couple applicants try to appeal as late as a year after their denial, which seems a little outside the bounds of what's reasonable. And because of ODE's other responsibilities, sometimes it's taken them up to a year or even 2 years to process an appeal, which is a long time to keep families and students on hold and charter developers on hold. So talk to ODE. You're welcome to, of course, talk with them, but this is why the amendment is proposing 150 days for them. They realized last week this bill's up. We better give some input. As opposed to the 190 days we proposed, it would require charter applicants to appeal within 90 days of their denial by the district of their charter application, and it would require the State Board of Education to process the whole thing, including mediation, from beginning to end, in about 150 days.
Thank you. Representative Rumble?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess the reason that I'm here about this is that there really are two factions in our state around charter schools. There are people who truly believe that charter schools can add something to the educational opportunity for students in Oregon in a positive way. And there are people who fundamentally do not believe that charter schools should exist. And I know many of those people, and they are well-meaning people on both sides. They have deep feelings about this issue. From my perspective, when that happens, and if we have charter schools, then we need to be clear so that people don't use the system to circumvent the idea that we have charter schools in Oregon now. It is part of our state law. And so how do we make sure that the playing field is fair for all those people? I, like Representative Dahlem, agree that competition can be a real positive thing. I don't think, personally, that you need to go out and have charter schools that are not public charter schools to create that competition. Public charter schools who have, without either the state school board or the local school boards, responsible to make sure that they evaluate that and that the education for those kids is happening in appropriate ways, for me, is really important. That's one of my goals and my core beliefs, is that we can do a good job with citizens who are on school boards and others to make sure that the opportunities that are offered our kids are the best. You know, I used to tell teachers in my school that when I grew up, we had two or three magazines. You know, we had Look, Life, and Time magazine. And that was kind of the way we saw the world. And now you go and if you don't have a particular expertise, you don't even know what that magazine's about. I mean, there are billions of them. Well, things have changed, and the opportunities that exist for kids and the best way to them to learn have also developed. And there are better ways to offer education to people. I wish, personally, that my high school could have offered everything it needed for every student that walked in that door, and that we had something available there to meet their individual needs and to do things for them so that they could blossom to their fullest. It was clear to me that we didn't do that. I mean, we worked hard and we tried, and every one of our teachers worked harder than anybody I know in any other business. But the reality is, every once in a while, some other people came along with a vision and a passion, and I watched that and I said, why would we stop that from being transferred to those kids? And, you know, with limitations, and I think that's what the bill talks about, is there are limitations to that, to provide that. And then other teachers in our building looked at that and said, wow, they're being successful with a group of kids we weren't successful with. What should we have done differently? And I will tell you that most of the teachers looked at it that way. It was what could I have done to have helped that student be more successful in my class? What can I do today to make that next student choose to stay here, because I really want to have all those kids here learning the best they can? And it is a good way to cross-pollinate our school system so that we continue to thrive at becoming the best at what we can do. I like the dash ones, because it still leaves the option available to school districts to put conditions, because I think there are, for different reasons in different places, appropriate conditions that should be placed on charter schools as they're going, so that school districts can feel comfortable when they're making decisions to accept this charter school, that it's going to be there next year for these kids, and we aren't going to start something that's going to start and fall apart, and all of a sudden the school district is going to have these kids coming back who are not happy with where they were, and they weren't happy with where they were to begin with. So what does that do for that local school district? Charter discussions in school districts can be very divisive in a lot of different ways, and that we need to make sure that when we finally get something that we agree to, that it's going to be there for a while. And so from my perspective, that's why the dash ones are a better choice if we're going to make any of those kinds of choices.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Representative Dahlem.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Madam Vice Chair. I would like to say that overall, generally speaking, for the charter movement to be successful and to be operated with public money, it has to be, in my opinion, a part of the public school system and under the jurisdiction and control of the school board. So that if our charter school starts out and does well, we may walk across the street or whatever the distance is and say, how are you doing that, and learn from them. If our charter school does not do well, we may walk across the street and say to those students, welcome home, and know something about them and where they are and what we have to do to get them fully into the game. Now, I see this bill, House Bill 3179, as strictly a due process piece. We have been working on, are charter schools fair? Are they equitable? But we do need the process, and the process has to be a process that's transparent, that everyone can see, particularly when we give conditional approval. When we give conditional approval, it's incumbent upon the school board to demand that certain reasonable expectations for educational success are there. I think that the original 25 offers opportunity for that. I too would share Arnie's recommendation of the Dash 1. But as long as those conditions are within law, rule, policy, and good, sound educational school board policy, then I think we should make the process work. Once we get into the approval process for the charter, it seems to me that the charter and the district have an obligation to say yes or to say no. And if they say yes, then they say yes, and this is what you must do. And if our charter often does it, then they must be a charter. And they must be given the length of time that both agree to, 2, 3, 5. I think that's about the limit of it. The charter and off they go. If the answer is no, then in deference to both. The charter knows where to go. It knows what to do. It knows who to see. And it knows what its next step is. So what I see the bill is doing is expediting due process. Thank you.
Any questions for this panel? Representative Cannon?
I do. Thank you. This is such an interesting topic, isn't it? I mean,
it is.
And our charter school law in Oregon, it tries to walk a very difficult line between creating competition and sort of alternatives to the public system and keeping that power in the hands of our publicly elected entities, our school boards, and the charter school sponsor, of course, has to be the school board. School board has to approve. And this proposal would, I think, gets in that place and tries to sort of move that line a little bit and say, well, as long as the charter applicant is doing what the legislature intends for the charter to do, then the board has to come closer to approving it. I struggle with this because I feel like we elect our school boards in a public system to govern our school system, and we say to them, if as voters we might be really supportive of charter schools. I'm in the faction that Representative Roblin said that supports charter schools, and if my school board isn't looking very sympathetically at them, I want to elect someone else to the school board. But that's the way our public system works, is we have elections, we have boards, and they make the decisions. And so I'm just expressing, and I don't quite have a question. I thought maybe I'd come up with one, but I didn't. I'm expressing my... If I keep going, maybe I will. But I'm expressing my just that note of discomfort legislating this more and making it more politicized in a sense.
Let me dig a question out of there for you, Representative Cannon, and that's the relationship between an elected board and how education is provided in the district.
Wait, Representative, because we have some more witnesses on both these bills.
I will be quick. The point is that when a charter school is established, and I look at Karn, they draw from students that have not been participating in the system. And those parents that are not in the system should not be denied the system, but should be given, again, an arrow to put in their quiver so that they might have a chance to offer some sort of alternative education to their children that would still be part of the Oregon education system.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Why don't we have Mr. Green and Mr. Kramer come up, and we'll continue the discussion on 3179, and then we'll ask after Mr. Kramer's finished. And the comments are completed on 3179. We'll ask Mr. Hinkle to come up and join Mr. Green on 3178. And state your name for the record.
Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, I am Rob Kramer. I'm with the Oregon Education Coalition. I'm also the founder of the Oregon Charter School Service Center, which since 1999, when the charter law was established, we've been assisting charter school operators with the startup and approval phase of getting their school going. I really appreciate what Representative Roblin and Cannon said about, you know, there's a natural tension at times between school boards and school districts and the charter starter, and at times that tension is of high conflict, and sometimes there is a use of the process in approving the proposals, using that process to stop the proposal. I see this bill, 3179, as a way to try to prevent some of the abuses that I've seen in the 3 to 4 dozen charter school applications that I've been involved with since 1999. I put those abuses in three different categories. Number one, I been a lot of mention of the use of the conditional approval for mechanism for approving the charter schools. I personally think that our law doesn't allow that right now. They shouldn't be giving conditional approvals. There should be a different way of handling this altogether, and here's why. Here's kind of what happens. A charter school proposal is made, and it goes through the hearing process, and then oftentimes the board will meet in executive session, decide what the conditions they want to be put on the approval. Then they'll come to the board meeting, pass a resolution with as many as 13 different conditions on the approval. Many of them, the charter school operators, may have never heard about up till that time. Things such as changing the term of the contract, things such as very vague requirements about dealing with ESL kids, things such as having a facility in place and ready to go by March of the year before your opening, which wouldn't even be financially feasible or realistic for a charter school to do. We think that that is not really an appropriate way to approve a charter school. If the board, the law says that the board shall approve or deny the charter, and then the two parties, once approved, shall negotiate a contract which reflects the provisions of the duly approved charter. I think if the board has conditions they want to put on a charter school, they should actually deny the school and list each one of those conditions as reasons for denying. And the law also anticipates they can also add remedies. If you want to change this, we'll approve it if you remedy each of these conditions in this way. And so the onus would be upon the board to say, we deny, here are the reasons, and there's a remedy for each of these reasons. Here's why it should handle this way. If a charter school is given a conditional approval and they can't stomach the provisions or the conditions on that approval, they can't appeal it to the state. We take it to the state and say, well, we think it's a denial. We can't take these conditions. They've denied us. The state says, no, it's an approval. And so all the board has to do to stop a charter school proposal is layer on conditions that they know are poison pills for the charter school. And now they're in this kind of vortex where they can't appeal it to the state because it's been approved. It hasn't been denied. That's why we think that the appropriate way is to deny the school, list the conditions as reasons, give a remedy for each, and then if the charter school does not want to meet those conditions, it has a denial. It can then appeal. That's how I think the law should work. This bill doesn't directly speak to that, although it attempts to, and I think it could be cleaned up by amendments to do that explicitly. The second problem area we've run into, which this bill tries to correct, is one in which a duly approved proposal goes to now the contract negotiation phase. And what we have seen time and time again is a contract is submitted to the charter school which doesn't reflect the provisions of the proposal. Material things are changed unilaterally by the school district. And the charter school operator says, well, wait a minute. We proposed and had approved a 5-year contract. And the lawyer now says, here's a contract for 3 years. And the charter school says no. And the school district attorney says, okay, no school. And at times, the stalemate has gone on for 18 months to 2 years. In one case, in the exact such circumstance, the school district's attorney representative actually made a recommendation to the school board that because the charter school wouldn't negotiate or accept the 3-year contract, that they should rescind the approval when the school board approved a 5-year contract. Now, this happens time and time again where the school boards are unilaterally making changes to the contract which don't reflect provisions of the duly approved proposal. This is not an isolated thing. It happens time and time and time again, even though the statute says that the sponsor and the charter school applicant shall negotiate a contract which reflects the provisions of the duly approved proposal, and they may agree to changes. But instead of may agree to changes, they're having unilateral changes basically required of them. And when they don't agree, well, the school board is perfectly happy with having no charter school. All they have to do is say, fine, we don't want the contract anyway. So the charter schools are finding themselves in the situation of negotiating a contract with a counterparty who doesn't want the contract quite often. Now, that's a, you know, asymmetrical situation of interests, and it's an untenable situation for the charter schools. This bill tries to deal with that, and I think it could do so in a better way, which could be also dealt with in amendments. Finally is the question of having charter school proposals discouraged by having onerous burdens on the proposal, which are these new policies that Karen Heike spoke of, new policies which say this The charter school proposal must include things like a full-blown alignment of all the curriculum with the state standards and policies for everything from discipline to, full-blown school policies at the time of proposing the school. That's not reasonable for a school. Those should be developed during the time of the run-up to the approval. And you can discourage a lot of charter school proposals by making onerous and unreasonable burdens on the front end at the proposal stage, and this tries to deal with that too. For those reasons, I support this bill, and I urge you to join in support. Thank you.
Any questions? We'll do some questions first. Then right now? Okay, right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not quite sure how you want me to proceed because I did sign up on both bills. So which bill is it you'd like me to?
Yeah, I think we're on 79 right
yes.
now.
79.
We'll
okay.
78.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Have some handouts for the committee.
Don't feel bad, though. There were a couple of us that had the same kind of problem.
I'd like to talk about small remoteness. Oh, I'm sorry. For your record, Jim Green, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. What's coming out in your packet that I've just handed to your committee assistant is a variety of things. Unfortunately, I did not make 20 copies of the proposal that the Greater Albany School District received. You can see how thick that is, and you're going to get a thick packet. I did prepare an extra copy for you to take a look at. That's a proposal that a school district received. What is also in your packet that is being handed out to you right now, and I hope you do get an opportunity to look at that proposal. I think Rob, Mr. Kramer actually worked with that group on that proposal. What you're seeing come around right now is a sample contract that came from the district. I represented the Greater Albany School District in those negotiations on that charter school. That's the first document in that packet. Behind that are the resolutions that the board had before them at their hearing or at the decision point with regard to approving that school, conditionally approving that school, or denying that school. And you'll see there's six of them there. Conditionally approving for a year, up to 5 years, because the application asked for a five-year contract, and also then denying the application. And behind that, again, you have a copy of our sample policy, which has been, I think, talked about a little bit today, and hopefully I can answer some questions around that. We have some concerns about the way that 3179 was originally written. We do like the amendment that allows school districts still the ability to put some conditions on it, and I'd like to address a couple of issues that have come up with regard to conditional approval, and I hope that Mr. Kramer would agree with me on this. I can't speak for every school district as it relates to charter school applications that they receive. I'm speaking for the districts that I've worked with as their representative in negotiating charter school agreements. I think if you take a look at the conditions that I set out in the Albany one, and I would like to correct one thing that Mr. Kramer did say. School boards can't go into executive session and decide the conditions. Matter of fact, the districts I work with, we don't do that. If we go into executive session, what we're doing in executive session is discussing legal ramifications for approval or denial of the application, which is perfectly allowable under Oregon's executive session law. The districts I work with do not make any decisions in their executive sessions. That's in violation of the law. And as an attorney in the state, I could be liable for that action of those boards. So I want to make it very clear, at least the boards I work with, we don't do that.
Mr. Chair, how many school districts have you worked with, Jim?
Oh, on the issue of charter schools, Ms. Chairman, Representative Minnis, you know, we have 70 charter schools currently in the state. I'd want to say 15 to 20 I've worked with.
Okay. Maybe I'll hold my questions and let him finish. But, you're saying the school district you've worked with, so I kind of wanted to get the – what does that mean?
Though along that same line, what he's just said is truly state law. So hopefully no school district is doing it. I'm not saying
– Mr. Chairman, Representative Minnis, if they called me and asked me the question, I'd say you can't go into executive session to do that. That's a clear violation of the law. If you're going to have discussions about what may be in a condition, you've got to do that in a public meeting. As the board, you've got to do that in a public meeting.
How well are the school districts being policed on this point? If it sounds like it's a pretty common occurrence, so who's is it the Department of Education that gives them oversight if they're doing this sort of behavior? Is there
let me say, Jim, that when you go into executive session, and if I were a board member and I wanted to talk about conditions, I'd look at the attorney and say, can I talk about conditions? Well, if the answer is no, then look at the superintendent and say, are these conditions something? I understand the law, and I also understand that I think it's hard to say that when a school board goes into executive session, that they don't talk about things that are germane to the contract. To do so, they need that space, they need that time, and they will make it germane to the contract so that they can talk about it. They will not get hung out to dry one at a time in a public meeting. They can't. So I don't know the 70 districts you're talking about, and I've only served for four in Oregon, but I know that they have used the law to discuss the conditions.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dahlem, not the districts I represent. I can tell you that without follow, that they will not do that. And Representative Minutes, to your question, the Government Standards and Practices Commission polices the executive session law. So if a public body, whether it's a school district, county commission, city council, if they're found or alleged to be in violation of the executive session law, the complaint goes to the Government Standards and Practices Commission, and they investigate those.
Following on that, is the executive session open to the public?
Well,
then listen to the discussion?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Minutes, no. If it's a properly called executive session for which there are scripts in the Attorney General's manual on public records and public meetings, if they're properly called, then no. The media is allowed to be in there. They're requested not to report on the content and discussion, and they have the ability, as a matter of fact, under law, you're still required to keep minutes of that executive session. And those can be reviewed by the Government Standards and Practices Commission to see if there was a violation of improper discussion or decision made in the executive session.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair, how then would someone know there was a violation if they're not allowed to participate in the meeting?
Well,
and how would you make the complaint?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Minutes, they would have to make the complaint to GSPC, and GSPC has to investigate those.
How would they know there is a violation if they're not allowed to be in the meeting?
We won't keep doing this, but I will say that the way that I would know it is if they came out and they already had them in plant hand and there had not been a public discussion, it would be a pretty good indicator that there might have been discussions happening with them.
And
would be a tip to say something. Also, executive sessions are open to the press.
Sure. Correct.
The press can be there, and they have an obligation in their part if things are not appropriate in there to report it or otherwise. But
and with all due respect, I just heard him say that the press agrees to not print or
Ms. Chairman, Representative Minutes, I don't think the press has ever agreed that they're asked not to report, but in some instances there's reported activity in those executive sessions, which causes public bodies all across the state some consternation of the ability to have those frank discussions in executive session for those allowable instances when you can go into executive session. But the reason I handed out these conditions for you and the reason I gave you all of them is because I don't have those discussions with my clients and I don't know what they're going to do, and they're given each and every one of these for each meeting that they're going to do because the applications ask for a 5-year condition or a 5-year contract, and I give my boards 5 options, 6 because of the denial. But in the executive sessions I go into, I specifically prohibit my boards from discussing, are you going to deny or are you going to approve this application? That has to occur in a public meeting, and if my clients or any school board ask me how that occurs, that's the process that I advise them on. And you can take a look at these conditions, and I know Karin mentioned some, but you take a look at the conditions that are in this one, and one of the things I always tell school districts, and I think you've got, and Representative Cannon, I think you hit the nail exactly on the head. You've got a push-pull love-hate relationship, because there are some school districts, and I think Representative Roblin's school district, the Coos Bay School District, has done great things for charter schools and has worked very well for them. I wish all my members took a look at charter schools as they're supposed to under the law. I'll admit it. A lot of them don't, and that's where we've got some issues that have been brought forward today. But I think one of the things that you need to take a look at is we need to have the ability to conditionally approve, and Mr. Kramer and I have had this discussion before, and I don't think if you look down the list of the conditions that I generally place on charter schools, it's anything that would require them to, like, land a rocket on the moon. And trust me, I have had a school board member say, I'd like to put conditions in there so they just can't ever meet them. And my advice to them is, you can't do that. You can't say, land a rocket on the moon. What you can say is, you got to have a facility by a certain date. And what I always try to tell my clients is, find out what date works with the charter school applicant. Because you have said, we want this school in our district. So you should work with them to get that school in your district. We've also heard from Karin or Ms. Hikus that, you know, there was one that said you got to pay a superintendent $50,000 for their FTE and, you know, oversight on a charter school. If the district asked my advice on that, I'd say that's unreasonable. That's not part of the law. But there is part of the law about a facility and insurance and making sure that the building is safe for kids to be in. And I think those are appropriate conditions to put in there, and I think that's what the Dash Ones do get at. If you take a look at the contract that I put before you, are there differences between the contract and the proposal that is being handed around? Yeah, there are some differences between the contract and the proposal, because as you take a look at the contract on page 24, I haven't seen a proposal yet that comes in from a charter school applicant that deals with the issue of indemnification.
I think somebody disagrees with you. Body language change or something. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
And I also believe that you'll find differences in some of the contracts that you'll see between the application on the issue of student performance. And I think that's a negotiated point that needs to occur on what's going to happen with student performance, because the idea behind the charter school law and why we created it in Oregon in 1999 was to offer an additional tool in the toolkit of school districts to provide educational services to boys and girls across the state. And for the record, and I know Mr. Kramer and I negotiated this bill in 1999, we were the only school board association in the nation to support a charter school law. So we've been very active in creating the 70 charter schools that are in this state. One of the things I think you need to be sure of is that there is active negotiation that goes on between a charter school applicant and a school district. Because if you take a look at the application that's before you and the contract that's there, the district had some concerns with regard to the assessments that the applicant wanted to use and the scores that they wanted and who they wanted to compare the scores to. And the district placed in the contract, we'll compare your Oregon assessment scores against our district average for kids in third grade. And you have to perform at or above the district average, and the applicant wanted to compare it to three schools in the district. The district wasn't willing to go there. And so I think that's a point of negotiation. I agree with Mr. Kramer. I don't think you should send out a contract that makes dramatic changes to the application that the other side doesn't know isn't coming beforehand.
I'm going to have to quickly, because we've only got a minute or so before the next committee is supposed to be in here, and we have one other person has, if she has some testimony.
Well, and I'm building on the time, Representative Roblin, so I'd be willing to waive my time for the lady from the Trillium Charter School and come back on this.
Can I just ask him to address one thing, because I just raised a red flag. The 116 different demands when there's only 25 in lock. I think you should have an opportunity just quickly to address that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Minnis. If you take a look at that policy, and I talked to the person who wrote the policy, no longer works with the OSBA. I talked to him today on the phone to say, why this way? And he said, to be honest with you, Jim, this isn't something I came up with. This is something that our member districts asked us to prepare, and these were suggestions that districts had from across the state on information that they had asked charter schools for. And if you know anything about our policies, and a lot of people don't, if you take a look at the language there, it's bracketed. It's suggested stuff that districts could put in there. While there's a lot of stuff there, there's also the opportunity for copies of any policies. I think let's go down the list of policies, because I think they were mentioned specifically. All they have to say is we don't have those yet. But it's something that we thought ought to be there, and it's something that school districts have said we've asked for information from charter school applicants, and I think one is before you right now, and we never got the information back from the applicant. And we kept asking for the information on, your application is complete as it meets the minimum requirements in ORS Chapter 338. But there's additional information we'd like to know about curriculum alignment. Can you show us how your curriculum aligns with the state standards? Because one of the things they have to meet in charter school land is the content standards. So I think those are reasonable. I think maybe the list may be a little bit long, but we were asked by our members, and our members said, what are some of the things that districts are asking for? So we prepared that list. Our policy department prepared that list. I wish we had as much power as people in this building think we have to tell our districts to adopt that policy, because we don't tell school districts they have to adopt a policy unless you as a legislature tell districts you are required to adopt this policy. Then we tell our member districts, the legislature says, you got to adopt this policy. We may make suggestions to school districts on policies, but we do not tell them they have to adopt a policy unless and until the legislature directs us to tell our districts they have to have a policy on X, Y, or Z.
We better wait. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And do you have anything that you wanted to say on 378?
Mr. Chairman, there were a couple things in that bill that I just want to make sure that, and I think Ms. Hykus's testimony kind of clarified some of those issues for me. It doesn't require us to negotiate. If there's a reason that the district can say, you know, look, we're looking to exchange that property with a developer in an area that they're going to build new apartments, and we got to build a school out that way. I just don't want to tie the hands of our local school districts, and it sounds like that's not the case, and I just want to make sure that that's clear for the record.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you. Thank you, Bull. And we have one other person, Stephanie Hinkle, and she can come forward and as briefly as you can. Thank you. And then we'll have heard everyone.
Vice Chair Roblin and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Stephanie Hinkle. I'm the director of Trillium Charter School in Portland, Oregon. This is our fifth year of operation. This year we purchased our building. It cost us about $2.4 million that we really don't have built into our budget so much. And so I came initially to testify about the building piece of the legislation that's up about requiring districts to act in good faith. And from some people's perspective, it doesn't go far enough. In California, they have a law that requires districts to provide that space if they have open space. And that's had mixed reviews in California. We're not asking that. We are asking to have the conversations that make those relationships possible. You've heard all kinds of arguments, and we don't have any time, so I just want to say that in Oregon, we really are working hard to develop those relationships that Representative Cannon has spoken about. They don't really all exist. Some education is one of the most political things out there in the world, and it probably should be one of the least political. It's really about children, what they need more, and we're very passionate about it. But I do want to say for the record that our goal, certainly, in many of the charter schools I work with, is to develop those relationships. But sometimes charter schools have no power, really, and boards have a lot. And sometimes we need to even it out a little bit and give a little more guidance to boards so that the charter schools have a little more tools to use. So that's all. I don't want to take more of your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
One question if someone wants to ask.
We're actually over time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm going to close our public hearing on 31. Let's see if I get the numbers right.
78
and 79. Anything else for the?
Who's pushing us out of here? What committee is it?
A great committee on agriculture and natural resources. And now we'll close the meeting of the education.
I was worried about you.